Good afternoon, everybody. I'm David, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank all of you here. It's great to see a lot of people that I know and that I've known for a long time here. It's also nice to meet new people, and what a terrific facility this is. I'm so grateful that Visalia was able to take the conference and put it on, and you guys are doing a terrific job. You know, I was a little confused. I kind of had a wardrobe malfunction. And I know that might sound funny for a man, but I'm one of those guys who takes these things very seriously. And I was asked about a month ago to do this, and I was asked to do a history talk. So, no problem. So I brought my brown history tweed coat, see? If I was going to be a speaker, I would have worn my suit because that's appropriate attire for that type of venue. Well, it turns out it's kind of a hodgepodge of both. So I was really panicked a little while ago going, what do I do? Anyway, this is all I have. So I also, you know, it does, I notice it says, I'm a speaker, but it also says it's about history. And I also noticed that they actually gave me more time than they're giving Harold tonight. And that, yeah, if it was history, you guys would be dead asleep because you can't talk and keep it exciting. So it is actually, I am supposed to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope, and also the fact that, you know, I'm kind of a walking history of how hospitals and institutions committee works, and I think a lot of people in this room also are the same way, because I was brought in some ways by the H&I committee, I was then nourished by the H&I committee, and then I was sent out by the H&I committee, and that's kind of been my whole sobriety. So I'm going to tell you guys, share a little bit. I can't really share the history without sharing a little bit about who I am and where my information comes from. And so I'm going to do that. And I know there's a lot of people in this room that have heard me many times. So if you have, just please be quiet. Sit quietly. This is for everybody else who hasn't. You know, Michelle and Jason were supposed to be here, and they're not here yet, and it's too bad because my story kind of starts from Michelle my home group, by the way, is the New Sobriety Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It meets every Friday night in Santa Rosa at the Senior Center up in Sonoma County. So I hope to all see you all actually next year at the conference in Petaluma. But if you ever want to come to my home group, I'd be happy to buy you a cup of coffee and introduce you around. But Michelle is also a member of that's her home group also. And I think I was sober about 2 years, and she was sharing a story of something that happened to her as a little girl. And it reminded me of something that happened to me as a little boy. And it's actually the oldest memory I kind of have. And I was at that age, I was at the supermarket with my mother, and I was at that age where, you know, you can walk, but you can't really keep up, so they're kind of carrying you half the time, and, you know, you ride in the cart where you put your feet out the back and you sit up at the top. So whatever age that is, I have no idea. But we were in the checkout line, and right at eye level, right at hand level, actually, was Chiclets. It was a gum, which somebody told me they still make it, but I haven't seen it in years. But I remember asking my mom if I could have some Chiclets, and she said no. So I took a couple packs. And we got out to the station wagon, and she's loading the groceries into the station wagon, and looks over at me, and I got like a half a box in my mouth, just chewing away, you know. And she says, "Where'd you get that gum?" And I said, "From the store." And she started yelling at me, and she took me in and got the manager, and he started yelling at me. And I know what they were trying to tell me is you're not supposed to take, you know, steal. But what I remember thinking clear as a bell is I'll never tell her again when I take something. Yeah. So I, like my friend Norm says, I'm a thief by trade and an alcoholic by absorption. And I was stealing long before I ever picked up a drink. And I started drinking about a year ahead of my peers. And I was the kind of guy that once I started drinking, I was already drinking as often as I could. I remember I would go into the Thrifties at 3 o'clock, because every Thrifty's in the world is designed the same way. You walk in and you've got the ice cream and candy section and the liquor department and the rest of the stores on the left. Well, if you went in at 3 o'clock, the junior high got out, and all the kids would be at the candy section, and every employee in the store would be watching the candy section for kids stealing candy, and I'd go back to the liquor department and just clean them out. And I was doing that real early, and I went from being, I was never a really good student. I was the kind of student. I remember when I was in grammar school, they used to give you grades for like effort and conduct, and I'd always get D's and F's, and I'd get C's and B's everywhere else. And I'd bring my report card home, and my mother, by the way, was a math teacher with a degree in English, and so I'd get a C in English, and I'd be thrilled because that was never easy for me. And she'd start yelling at me, and she used to get really mad at because I'd get a D or an F in effort. And the irony is, this is the typical alcoholic. I'm a little kid. It's like, I don't even know what effort means. I have no idea what it means. But all I'm thinking is, why is she upset? I got a C in English. I don't understand. And this is how I was. I never asked her, what does effort mean? And that was the story of my life. I thought I was supposed to know, and I didn't know. And I just kind of kept stumbling. And when I started to drink, I went down real fast. And I got thrown out of 3 schools in that next semester. And, it was a nightmare. And what ended up happening, the next few years, I made some rebounds, and they sent me to psychiatrists and all that typical stuff. And I also like to mention that, I'm the only alcoholic in my family. I have 5 brothers and sisters. They're all normal. They all work. They all take baths. They all do the normal things everybody does. I don't know what happened to me. I really don't. I come from a fairly decent family, and I just don't know what happened. But I could never, it's just like I couldn't quite function. Well, how I left Southern California, and I grew up in Southern California, and how I left really gives you a picture of who I was. I could no longer be around my family because, remember, I'm a thief. And also, and I don't know, I'm a lazy thief. What that means is I'm going to steal from anybody I can, and the closer you are, the easier it is, unfortunately. So how I left Southern California is I loaded up everything from my brother's house into my sister's car, and I took off. And that's who I am. I was driving... Is it me? This is me, right? So I ended up, I'm heading up north. I have no idea where I'm going. In my sister's stolen car with all my brother's stuff. Wondering why I did it. This was a typical behavior of mine. I would do stupid things, and then I would think to myself, why did you just do that? And then my next thought would be, have a drink and don't think about it. And that's what happened. So I landed in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, and everybody I met there was a liar, cheat, and a thief just like me, so I fit. And that's where I was for the next 10 or 12. Actually, 6 months later, I was on my way to Lompoc Federal Penitentiary, and it just kind of kept going downhill. But is that cutting out still? When I wasn't in prison, I was on the streets of San Francisco. And that's just kind of what happened for the next 12 years. It was a blur. I kept going down further and further. I kept getting arrested. And to get to where I was when I finally got sober, I'd just gotten out of state prison. I'd been out for 2 months. And I was living on the library lawn in San Francisco, and I was drinking Wild Irish Rose White Label. And because I was trying to keep a low profile, and it didn't cost much. And I knew I was in trouble. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm an alcoholic. How I have to mention the part that drugs played in this is that they kept me from admitting I was an alcoholic for a long time. And it also forced me to steal more because they were more expensive. And so when I was trying to keep a low profile drinking that Wild Irish Rose, I remember one of the things that happened is when I first, a guy was telling me, here, try this, it'll help. So I drank about a half a bottle, and I remembered thinking, my God, if I'd have discovered this 12 years ago, I wouldn't have had to go to prison so much. It's only 80 cents a bottle. And that's when I knew I was in trouble. You know, I ended up, somehow I ended up in a detox up in Sonoma County. And this second day I was in that detox, I was so sick. I had the whips and jingles so bad I couldn't roll a cigarette. I had the dry heaves, you know, the runs. I couldn't eat anything. There was a girl there spoon feeding me oranges so that I could hold down some vitamins. I was a mess. And what kept going through my mind is, why am I so sick? I mean, I just got out of prison 2 months ago, and I'm hardly doing anything. But, you know, when we talk about the progressiveness of this disease, one of the things I realized later on when I did get sober is that every time I detoxed, the older I was, the harder it got, and the less I was doing. And that's what happened to me. My body just couldn't take it anymore. You know, I also realized, thank God I got locked up as much as I did, because I really don't believe you can drink and use the way I do and last very long. You know, I'm certain I would have been dead, because I never stopped. I never understood the word stop. So, you know, so thank God that the state of California stopped me enough times to get me here. But anyway, so I'm in that detox that second day, and again, I'm just sick. And, well, by the fifth day, you know, the first things that get well in an alcoholic is our ego and our hormones. Because by the fifth day, I'm looking at the girl spoon feeding me oranges thinking, man, she looks good. You know, like I had anything at all to offer. I mean, I'm in the same pants I got out of prison in 2 months earlier. But that's how my brain worked, you know. And then I also was thinking, you know, if I just go back to the library lawn and work out of Bobby's store and don't drink, everything will be fine. You know, and that's where, to me, the big book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about self-delusion. And that's when I realized, and I didn't realize it at that moment, but that's where I realized I suffered from self-delusion. How could I could never not drink of my own since I had started. And what in the world made me think I could just stop? You know, that's not denial. That's delusion. That's absolute delusional. I hadn't been able to do that my entire life. So I ended up going, you know, this is where the H&I committee comes in, though. They brought me, they brought a meeting into that detox, and they brought me a soft cover edition of the big book. And so I took it back to my library lawn because I left that detox. And you know what I did? I bought a bottle on the way back before I got on the bus. Actually, I think I stole a bottle. Whatever. I got a bottle. But I was camping under a streetlight reading this book because it was the only book I had. And I read it from cover to cover, and it didn't make a bit of sense to me. But the second time through, I got to page 37, and it's on the chapter on more about alcoholism. And it goes into a stupid analogy of a jaywalker. It says our behavior is like a guy who can't stop jumping in front of cars. No matter what he does, you know, for those of you who've been around, you all know that story. Well, right at the end of that story, it says, you might think this illustration is ridiculous, but we who have been through the ringer have to admit that if you substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. And that was the first thing in the book that made any sense to me. I remember thinking, my God, I'm a jaywalker. I know my problem. I understand now. But, you know, that got me back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I came into these rooms, and I gave it a shot. I went back to Santa Rosa, and I started going to meetings, and I just gave it a shot. You know, I did pretty much what people said. I got a sponsor. You know, and it was kind of interesting. I will say this. I was around 15 months and I drank. And I drank for one day. And about a month before I drank, I'd gotten another sponsor, and that was Ronnie Crawford. And I can use his last name because he's told me to, and plus because I'm going to go into the history part. And I really believe that for the history part, we need some last names on there. And I, anybody's last name who I've used, I have their permission. Otherwise, I wouldn't use it. And also, some of them are dead now. But the important thing is we need at some point to have some kind of reference to who these people are that passed this thing along. And to me, and I am a student of history. I've always been a student of history. Even when I was out there and in prison, I used to read books on history. I just like history. But anyways, I'll get to the history here in a bit. But so anyway, where was I? I lost my place. I'm one who drank, right. And I had gotten Ronnie as a sponsor right before I went out. And when I came back in, I went out and I drank for one day and I was devastated. I didn't understand why I couldn't stay sober. And I remember it took me, I'm a runner. You know, I'm the kind of guy that just, I got to run. And so before I drank, that's what I did. I ran to San Francisco and I drank. Then I woke up there and I was there with this friend of mine, Tommy, who I'd known for 10 years in and out of jail, you know. I remember waking up in his house, and I'd been telling him how wonderful it was in sobriety that previous year. So I woke up, and Tommy looks at me, and he goes, "Man, you got to go back." You know, even Tommy had a heart. You know, he had a hustle, and it was his way of life. And he used to think, "Man, this poor guy used to take care of me because I just had, you know, I could rip and run, and that was about all I was good for." So anyway, I did. Before I went back, though. You know, they talk about the ego being the killer of the alcoholic. And if you're somebody who's been around and gone out and come back, I know what you're going through. Because I'll tell you what, that ego almost killed me. I wanted to come back, but I was afraid to come back and tell anybody I drank. And then, you know, I ended up in San Rafael, which happens to be right between San Francisco and Santa Rosa. And because I'd been around a year, I had a car, and I had all my clothes in my car, and that's where I was living for like 3 days in my car trying to decide what to do. And I went through all the mental gymnastics. You know, well, let's see, I could just go back. Nobody saw me drink. I don't have to admit it. Or maybe I could just start here. Or, you know, all that stuff. But I'll tell you what, being around you people for a year, I knew I couldn't pull it off. And not only that, what happened is finally, on that third morning, I woke up in my car, and I had one thought that kind of drowned everything else out, and that was, if you don't go back and figure out whatever it is you're running from, you're never going to quit. And that scared me. And so I came back, and I went over to Ronnie's house, and I knocked on his door, and he opened the door, and I said, "Ronnie, I drank." And he said, "It's not my fault." Can you hand me my phone? I said, but I remember saying, "What's wrong with me? How come I can't get this thing? Yeah, I need the real stuff. I said, "What's wrong with me? How come I can't get this thing?" And he told me, actually, there's quite a bit. I mean, I would sit there and go, "But I had 15 months." And he'd tell me, "It's not about time. It's about a way of life." You know, and I remember saying, "What's wrong with me? How come I can't get this thing?" And he said, "Lack of power is still your dilemma." You know, and then he told me what I truly believe changed my life. He said, "Remember this, praying is just like drinking. If you have a drink and that doesn't do what you want, what are you going to do? You're going to have another one. And if that doesn't do what you want, you're going to have another one." He said, "You're going to keep drinking until it does what you want. If you'll apply that to prayer, you'll stay sober. I guarantee it." And I know that sounded hokey, you guys, but I was as willing as a dying can be. And I will say this. I had gotten Ronnie about a month before I went out. And this was a man that just really had what I wanted. I mean, he had what I wanted, and I was willing to do anything he told me. So when I came back, I got a room in a pantry off of the kitchen over on in this part, West Avenue in Santa Rosa. And it was like one of these old houses that had a walk-in pantry, and it had a little curtain on there, and it was turned into a bedroom. I had a bar with my clothes hanging from it, and there was a mattress, and I probably prayed 20 to 30 times a day, asking God just to remove the obsession to run, because I wanted to run really bad. I started going to meetings, and I hated it. My very first meeting, by the way, I came back, it was a Tuesday night when I went to Ronnie's house. That following night, Wednesday, was the first Wednesday of the month, which was the H&I business meeting. And I had a couple H&I commitments before I went out, and I'd only been gone a week, so I had to go back in, and I had to give up all my commitments. And I'll never forget that, sitting there just humiliated. And I remember they said, well, and so-and-so is the coffee maker, needs to rotate out. And Ronnie nudges me and says, you can do that. So I took the coffee commitment. So I've had a commitment in H&I since the day I got sober. But I was praying in that pantry, and I was going to meetings, and I hated it, and I was really, I just wanted to run really bad, and I hated you people, and by the way, I got sober in the month of November, and the topic was gratitude all month, and I got sober on November 5th, so I'm having to listen to this all month. It's like driving me nuts. Finally, about 3 weeks in, I'm at a Tuesday night meeting. And there were some people there I hadn't seen before I went out. And immediately my brain's thinking, what are they thinking about me? What are they saying? Because I had to raise my hand as a new person. And so, you know, that's that self-centeredness that we suffer from. And I'm just sure they're talking about me. And this girl comes up to me at the break, and I swear I didn't say a word to her. She walks up to me and says, remember, the people that mind don't matter, and the ones that matter don't mind. And what I understand about that today is that it's not so much what she said. It was the idea that here was a person I hadn't said a word to that read my brain, that knew exactly what I was thinking about. And to me, that is the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the fact that no matter where you've been, somebody got there before you. Somebody knows exactly where you're at right now. And that's how the miracle of AA, for me, that's exactly what it is. Very next night, I was at a men's stag, and again, the topic was gratitude. But I heard a guy say, if you can't be grateful for where you are, be grateful for where you're not. And boy, I sure was glad I wasn't back out there tearing it up one more time. So that's kind of how it started for me. I woke up the next day in the pantry, and I remember seeing my clothes hanging up and being grateful I hadn't lost all my clothes. As you can tell by my wardrobe malfunction, I'm very concerned about clothes. But of course, I didn't have any before I got sober. And every time I went to jail, I came out with nothing. So... And I'm not going to tell the story because I want to go into some other things. But I woke up in this pantry. I remember saying, thank God I didn't lose my clothes. And then I remember looking at this pantry and thinking, you know, if you put a sink and a toilet right next to this bed, it would be the exact size of a single cell. And it wasn't. I could walk in and out. And I remember saying, thank you, God. And what I know is that was the day the obsession to drink or run left me. And that was over 15 years ago. So God did for me what I can't do for myself. You know, and I told you guys I wasn't sure why I drank. One of the things I realized is that I just didn't know enough of honesty. You know, honesty for a guy like me was real hard because I was a liar, cheat, and a thief all the way through my life. And so that first time around, that first 15 months, two things. One is I didn't have any spiritual connection. You guys would talk about God, and I'd say, yeah, I believe too, because I didn't want to be different. But I had no connection. And so, you know, when Ronnie had me praying like that, that's where I got the opportunity to realize that God could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I also will tell you that I didn't wake up that morning and know the obsession was gone. It took about 6 months before I could look back and realize that was when it had left me. That was the neat thing about it. It just kind of happened. But I also, you know, I was so dishonest that I'd be in these meetings and people would talk about honesty. And they talk about self-honesty. And I'd think, okay, so if I lie to you, and I know I'm lying to you, I'm still being honest with myself. This is why it took a while for me. Some of the things that happened early in sobriety that I want to share with you. So actually, I'm going to share two. Oh, God, I have so much time, but I won't go till three, you guys. I promise I won't put you to sleep. But I do have a lot of things I want to share about H&I and the history, but I also want to kind of finish because you need to know who's sharing this. You need to know the guy who's sharing this. I mean, by the way, I am a guy who dropped out of high school. I have no education to speak of. Yeah, I have a little bit of college. That was my claim to fame, is that I went back to college in my 20s and made a go of it. And then, of course, it got in the way of my drinking. But Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything I have in my life. And that's part of the miracle of this, of what I want to share with you about sobriety. You had to learn how to work. I didn't know how to work. I was a really good clerk in prison. You know, I could type, but I didn't know how to hold a job. I didn't know how to disagree without being totally disagreeable. I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. So I got a job, and through a series, I won't go through the whole thing, but when I had about 4 years, I'd been working with this company for quite a while, and they offered me this promotion, and, you know, with a whole lot more money if I took it, if I took over Alameda County, and I said, great, this sounds great. So I took it, and I never got the money. Yeah, I got the responsibility, but no money. You talk about a resentful alcoholic. And I had to learn how to deal with that. I remember going to Ronnie, I want to quit. And he'd say, no, you can't. Why not? Look, don't you see what they did to me? And he said, yeah, life's not always fair, is it? So remember this, life is not always fair. It's our reaction that's important. And no, you can't quit because A, you don't have another job lined up, and B, you can't quit in the middle of a resentment anyway. Ronnie was brutal. He never gave me a break. He'd call me idiot all the time. One time we were sitting in a meeting. I had about a year, and the girl who shared had it. Actually, I had 2 years, and the girl who shared had a year. And she called on her sponsor, and her sponsor got up and said, "Oh, you're so wonderful. You've changed so much. I love you." And I leaned over to Ronnie and I said, "How come you never pat me on the back like that?" And he said, "I would, but you're so busy patting yourself, there's no room for me." He was brutal. But anyways, so I had to work through that resentment, and I did. And I won't go into the whole how of it, but it was no problem. And after, because there's 12 steps, you know, you work the 12 steps on it, and you go, oh, this was our course. You know, these people who harmed us are sick too. And there was other things I did also that just helped me get through it pretty simply. And once I did, then I remember sitting at Ronnie's house, and he goes, "Let me ask you, was this job ever meant to be a career?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Maybe it's time you start thinking about a career." Now, I had never thought, you know, this is why I remind you, I'm a high school dropout. I didn't even know what my skills were. I know I'm not very good at digging ditches. I'm terrible at fixing things, you know, and I run from problems. So what kind of a job, you know, works into that? So I remember thinking, you know, I come from a long line of salesmen, and I can honestly tell you that every job I've ever had, they pushed me to sales, including the one that they gave me the promotion. And by the way, that was part of how I worked through it, was I had to do some marketing as part of this new responsibility and run some crews, but I didn't actually have to do any of the physical work. So even though I wasn't getting any more money, it was still easier work to me. I found I could do it with very little effort, which is something I still look for today, which can be a problem. But anyway, so I ended up, my whole family's salesman. My dad's a real estate broker. My brother's I have a brother and sister both in real estate or in the related industries. And then I have another brother who has a insurance agency. So we're kind of salesmen. And I thought, you know, if they can do it, maybe I can. So I thought I'd get my real estate license. So I tell the story for a reason. I go down, I take the test. So I take the classes, then I take the test, I pass the test, then you have to apply for your license. And I applied for my license, and they said no. Well, I told you guys I have some felony convictions. Well, I have 4 of them are embezzlement, grand theft, robbery, and fraud. And they said, "We're not giving you a license." I hadn't told this story in a long time, just to get sidetracked, but when I was real new, the one thing I could do is books. I'm just always had a kind of a math brain. So I remember when I was brand new, I thought I'd go get a job working as a bookkeeper or something. So I interviewed with this guy, and he goes, "Well, have you ever been convicted of a felony?" I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Well, for what?" I said, "Well, which time?" You know. And then I said, "Well, I got an embezzlement. Oh, and a grand theft." You know, I just didn't click that, oh, they might not want to hire me, you know? Anyway, so getting back, now but I did what a normal person would do. I appealed it, and it took me a full year, actually, to get my day in court. And I tell you the story for a reason. It was a Wednesday in Oakland at 1 o'clock. the hearing. Was it 1 or 10? I can't remember. Carmen was there. My father flew up from Palm Desert. My brother flew up from San Diego. That employer who I wanted to strangle showed up. And then a whole bunch of people from AA all showed up. They all took time off of their lives at their expense to come testify on my behalf. The miracle, you guys, is I didn't ask anybody to come. I was through taking from people. I was through using people. And I didn't ask anybody to come. And these were people who just said, no, we're coming. And it was a real emotional day. I had to take my brother and father back to the airport right after the hearing. So I drove back from Oakland to Santa Rosa on my own, and I remembered on the way home, it just dawned on me real clear. It didn't matter if I got my license or not. I had found what was important in life. I had people that I loved and cared about a great deal. And you know, I think that's the gift of AA. Somewhere in the process of those steps, and for me it happened around the seventh step, so I just quit taking so much, and I started to give a little bit, and I started to care a little bit. And as that happened, I started to get people in my life. And anyway, so that was a real emotional day. I did get my real estate license, and I've been doing that a long time. Yeah. And actually, I just wanted to go full circle, because there's now a full circle to my story, and it just happened last year. So you can ask my wife, I'm just kind of an entrepreneur. It's like I've got to get my hands into things. And I'm still doing real estate, but I always want something else too. Drives her nuts. But so the opportunity came up last year for an investment, which was some self-serve car washes, you know, coin-operated car washes. A huge expense. I mean, the biggest expense is buying them. Once you have them, they're cash cows. But, you know, they cost a lot of money. Well, I didn't have enough money. I could leverage myself to the till, and I still wouldn't be close. So I thought, I called my brother, one of my brothers, and I said, Mike, would you be interested in looking at this? And he was like, all over it. So Mike and I started working this deal, and we purchased these car washes. Now, here's the miracle of this story. My brother Mike lives in Santa Maria, which is, you know, halfway to Southern Cal. The car washes are up in my neck of the woods in Santa Rosa. So, you know, obviously I'm the one collecting the money, and he's got to trust me to get his money and all that. And the irony is, that's the same brother whose stuff I stole when I left L.A. It's the same brother. Talk about full circle. I remember right before these closed, I remember telling Mike, I said, you know, whether this happens or not, I just want you to know I don't take lightly the fact that you trust me. And you know, he said, you know, there's nobody I trust more. And I could go on, I could tell you for hours stories about me trying to make amends to him. And he's the kind of guy that loves to have the upper hand. So I had to start getting creative to get him to accept things. And, of course, every now and again, but he's also a good salesman, and he appreciates a good sale. So every now and again, I could con him in some way where and then he'd go, okay, you got me, that was good, you know. But it's, anyway, the idea that I have my family back, you know, at Thanksgiving, one year, and every year I have a whole house full of my family who come up for Thanksgiving. And what a gift, what a gift. So how does this all tie in? That's who's talking to you here, okay? This is who I am. My upbringing in H&I, and that I do want to talk a little about, is because hospitals and institutions has always meant a tremendous amount to me. I started off making coffee, and in our area, which is Santa Rosa, Area 22, you know, we average over 100 people a month at our business meeting. We are a very fluid, solid area. A lot of how this started was through my sponsor, Ronnie, who was just huge on bringing, you know, if you wanted him as a sponsor, you were going to go. And if you weren't going to go, you might want to find another sponsor. Because, you know, he comes from that old Norm Alpe school of, if you want what I got, you do what I did. You know, you do what I do. So, and Ronnie was a big history buff. And he got me, and by the way, my first tapes, before I was even very sober, he just threw Chuck Chamberlain, Norm Alpe, Clarence Snyder, all these old tapes, Bill and Bob, and I used to listen to them and fall asleep at night because, you know, it would keep my mind quiet. But it also gave me, you know, I used to listen to some of those old great speakers, Jack Brennan and John the Indian, and guys who are no longer with us that you know, are just that we all have in our, by the way, in our H&I library, and hopefully we can convert them to CD because eventually everything is going to be on CD. So, but anyways, that's where it kind of started. And as I mentioned, I always enjoyed the history. And I think about when I was first sober, Ronnie was a general chairman. And the steering committee meetings were in Santa Rosa because the way it used to be is the general chair always had the steering committee in their region. And then I think it was Jeff Soliday who changed that back in, but anyways, so they were in Santa Rosa. So I used to go there and I got to meet Jack Loomis. And I don't know if any of you remember Jack Loomis. I know Manuel does. Jack was one of these. When I think of Jack, I think of him yelling across the table at Jim. And just, you know, he was just brutal in those meetings. And then I remember going to his house in Pleasant Hill, and he looked at me and he said, "Remember, kindness, love, tolerance, and patience." Okay? Yeah. And yet my vision of him is screaming at Bob Harity or something, you know. And Bob, who couldn't be here today, I think I'm a fill-in for Bob. And Bob's been a tremendous H&I worker. And, you know, early on, we used to have history panels, and we used to purposely put Bob Harity and Bill Smith on the same time because they both had different memories of what happened. And so I started, but some of these guys, Sam was around, and Manuel. Manuel's just been a tireless worker. I think of Fresno, and I think of Manuel and Richard, and I think of just some of the great people, Mike and Kathy. And Kathy, I'd use her last name, but it changes every year, so I don't know what it is this year. That was worth it. I may hear about it later, but that was worth it. But, you know, some of those people, I put some notes here because I want to get into. But anyway, those were people that were all involved in the general committee. And Roger and Mary, of course, you know, they've been here as long or longer than anybody. Yeah. And, you know, what was interesting was they used to fight, but they did. We had like two different versions of what happened to certain things. And so I remember, and by the way, I went to the general committee meetings, and sometimes I know some of you know I can't keep my mouth shut at those meetings anymore, but it might shock you to know that I didn't open my mouth for over 3 years either. I went there, and I was very quiet because I wanted to learn. I wanted to see what these people had to offer, and what I got was a tremendous amount of respect for some of those people that have been around a long time, And I also, but it also made me real curious because I used to get two versions. And so I had the opportunity after I'd been around for a while to be the historian to do the archives. And I took them. And I'm sorry, Kathy, because I left them a mess for Kathy, because what I did was I took all the H&I archives to my home, into my garage, and I went through them all. And I literally read them. And it took me, ask my wife, I'd be up there in the middle of the night reading different stuff. Wow, look at this, you know, because I wanted to find out what the true history was. And what I was able to find a lot of the things they disputed. There was a couple things I still haven't found that just aren't in there. But you know, I got a sense of this committee. And what's really interesting is sometimes I see things happening at our meetings today and I realize, my God, this was going on 20 years ago. Nothing really changes, you know. And if we would just learn from our experience, we wouldn't have to repeat it so much. But anyway, so my H&I started like that. And I got cleared for the jails pretty quick. And I got cleared for our local jail right when I had 2 years sobriety. And I started doing that, and I got cleared at Vacaville. We used to do a meeting there. And I remember Vacaville used to be a reception center when I was going to prison. Now they have them all over the place. But back then, if it was in the north, you went to Vacaville. So, it was pretty neat for me to be able to walk in. And first time I went in there, you know, you walk down the main line to our unit, and I was, like, just loving it. I just, my chest comes out a little bit, and, you know, it's like, wow, this is too cool. So I started getting involved in this stuff. And when I had 5 years sober, My sponsor, many of you know Ronnie, they moved. They moved to New Mexico. And I remember I wasn't sure what I was going to do. You know, I really wasn't. I mean, it was like Ronnie was, I leaned on him a lot. And one of the greatest gifts he taught me, by the way, was to lean on God, not on him. And it still doesn't mean I didn't lean on him a little bit. But I am so grateful for that, you know. He taught me to lean on the 12 steps and on a higher power. He used to say, if you're in an airplane at 30,000 feet and you want a drink, who are you going to call? You better learn to call on a higher power because I won't be there. You know, he'd never call me back either. He was one of them sponsors, you know. Hey, you want what I got, you call me. Yeah, but I do. And leave you messages, you don't call me back. Well, then you got to call again. I remember one time after a week of calling him, he goes, I wish I could play those messages. You sound like a 2-year-old, you know. And I'd say, but I could have drank. Anyway. But, you know, when he moved, I didn't know what I was going to do. And what was interesting is I was doing a lot of H&I work locally with a guy named Ed Kruger. And Ed also doesn't mind me using his last name. And Ed and I started doing, we just got thrown together because we were both doing, we both loved doing prisons. And we started doing Folsom and we started doing Pelican Bay, which is all the way up by Oregon. And it was like a long, we'd go up. Actually, we made the mistake our first trip. Boy, these are some of the great experiences. You guys want to get involved in H&I, this is the way you do it. So the meeting's at Saturday, and you got to be at the institution at 9 a.m. So the very first time Ed and I decided to go up, we thought, well, let's just get up and we'll leave at 2 in the morning. It's a 4-hour drive, and we're going to meet Pete for breakfast up there. And 5-hour drive, excuse me. So we do. And, of course, neither one of us slept a lick. Well, Ed, and this is, Ed's a vegetarian. He doesn't eat meat. He doesn't eat sugar. He doesn't drink coffee. He runs 5 miles a day. He doesn't smoke. And at this time, I'm 280. I smoke. I've never seen a piece of meat or sweets I didn't like. And the irony is, you guys, I got closer to Ed in that next 2 years than I've ever been to any human being in my life. We just fit like peanut butter and jelly. Anyway, we drove up, so we left at 2 in the morning, and of course Ed's like, okay, I'll try some of your coffee. So I give him some coffee, and I go, you want a donut? Okay, I'll have a donut. So we get in to do this meeting, and Ed looks like a deer caught in the headlights. He hasn't slept, he's wired on sugar and coffee, and he's looking at me going, I got to change my sobriety date, you know? And so we're on the A yard at Pelican Bay, which is a level 4 yard, heavy duty. I mean, you know, 50 guys and they all sit with their backs against the wall because nobody, you know, I mean, it's very segregated, you know. And then as we're sitting there, Pete goes, oh, by the way, they wanted the speaker meeting. They heard you guys are guests, so you're going to be the speakers. And I mean, because normally, by the way, when we do those meetings, we just participate in their meetings, but... So, again, Ed's like the deer caught in the headlights. But this is where we found we were a good mesh. We found we were a good mesh because I remembered I saw Ed and my heart went out to him. And I thought, you know what? And plus, we were both just fried, you know, from that long drive, no sleep. But I thought, okay, I'm going to get up and I'm going to put some energy into this room and I'm going to turn it over to Ed. And that's exactly what I did. And he was as good as I'd ever heard him. And I found that I got to bring out the best in him. And that's where we made nice meshes. You know, we've done a lot of panels together, and we did a lot of things over those next couple of years before he moved. And he is an artist too, by the way, and I'm a salesman. Just absolute night and day. Anyway, and that's a relationship I got to develop simply from traveling long, long distances and doing service. You know, a couple of things that happened significantly to me, when I was 8 years, I was on a committee with the state where we were trying to improve relations, and it's still going today. But anyways, we were meeting at Jamestown, and so they put me up in a hotel, and I drove up to Jamestown, and we had our meeting that morning, and it went till 5 o'clock, and at 5 o'clock they go, all right, go have dinner, and if you'd like to go and do an NA meeting tonight on the Tuolumne Yard, come on back at 7. And I'm going to tell you, I'll be as honest as I can, you guys. I've never been to an NA meeting in this sobriety. I had years past, but I just don't do it. I also have been hammering in this committee trying to get the state to understand there's a difference between AA and NA, right? I mean, that's part of what we do constantly. That's still going on. Anyway. But I remember thinking, well, I got nothing to do tonight. Just go and be a visitor. Sit quietly. Keep your mouth shut. You don't have to participate, but at least you can go in. So I go back at 7 just because, again, I didn't have anything to do. And plus, these are things I have to learn in sobriety is, okay, you don't always have to express your opinion. You can allow things to happen and just... So I go in, I get there about 7:15, and a guy walks up and he goes, hey, by the way, if anybody wants to do an AA meeting on the Calaveras Yard, come with me. And I'm like, yeah, that's me. So I got to go, and the miracle, you guys, is Jamestown was the last prison I was in. I got to sit, and I was on the Calaveras Yard. And I got to sit on that yard and tell them, guys, I'd been there exactly 8 years before. What a gift. What a gift. So I'm going to tell you a quick story about, and this is getting into the history right now. And this is about Parlin Fork. I think Albert mentioned it. Parlin Fork is a fire camp that's 2 hours from Santa Rosa. It's a CDC fire camp, CDF, with CDC. And Ronnie, my sponsor, got sober in Parlin Fork. He got sober, and this is kind of the history, but this is also a pretty cool story of how AA works. He got a guy from North Hollywood named Ed Frank, whose sponsor at that time was Chuck Chamberlain. Ed and Bernadette moved up to Fort Bragg, and they didn't have anything to do, so they wanted to see if they could get a meeting going. So they went into Parlin Fork and got a meeting, and they used to take it in every week, and that's where Ronnie got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he ended up moving in with Ed and Bernadette when he got out of prison in Santa Rosa. And when Ed and I were doing all these meetings, we were doing Chamberlain Creek, which is another fire camp just a little closer than Parlin. And I remember telling Ed, we got to get Parlin Fork going again. You know, it hasn't been going since Ed quit doing it a long time ago. So we went ahead and we put in our names and we went through the procedure. We talked to the lieutenant. We got cleared. And we were heading up for a meeting. And the night we were heading up for the meeting, this is the other way Ed and I both, you know, we used to pat ourselves on the back and just, you know, we had a lot of fun. We'd be going, yeah, we're going to get this meeting going. We're going to fix these guys and, you know, all this grandiose stuff, right? So we get into Parlin. We go to sign in and the guard goes, so where are you guys from? And I said, well, from Santa Rosa. And he goes, oh, yeah, you know Ronnie Crawford. And I said, well, yeah, Ronnie's my sponsor. And he said, yeah, I was here when Ronnie was here. And it wasn't until he said that, and we were signing in, and it was like the day before Ronnie's 20-year sobriety birthday. In other words, that meeting hadn't been going for 17 years until right at Ronnie's 20-year sobriety birthday was the first day Ed and I got in there. And as soon as Ed and I realized it was Ronnie's birthday, we both just went pale because we'd been patting ourselves on the back for getting this meeting going the whole way up. And that's when we realized, you know what, this is God's idea, not ours. And it was God's way of letting us know, it's my idea, not yours. You're just doing what you're supposed to. And that is that was a miracle, but one of the things that I've realized through all those years is that, you know, Ronnie used to hammer that we got to learn how to do things quietly. And it's still a contention of mine. Sometimes I'm at the general committee, and I'm not to get into it, but I just hear these things, and it's like, when are people going to learn we don't need pats on the back? Let's do it quietly. Let's just do stuff. I try not to stand here and give you a resume of everything I do. It's ridiculous. It's not only ridiculous, it serves no purpose. What is important, here's the other thing I'm going to say. I love hospitals and institutions. I love the general committee. But I'll tell you what, if that general committee falls apart tomorrow, I'm still going to Parlin Fork. and I'm still going to the local jail. And if we have no money to buy books, doesn't matter. You know, we don't carry the literature into the alcoholic. We carry the message. The fact, you know, the fact that we have the funds to buy literature is a privilege and should be used accordingly and not abused. You know, those are all things that... The other thing I'm going to talk about on the history a little bit, because Ronnie was a big one on this back when he was chair. And I know they do in a lot of areas. You guys do treatment centers that take insurance. In Sonoma County, I'll tell you what, we won't do them. We won't do them. We'll do, if they're county facilities and they'll accept, or if they'll, even if they'll accept indigent people, by golly, we'll take them a meeting. But if you got to have insurance to get in there, then we're certainly not going to take them a meeting because you know what? That's not what this, our money is not to buy literature so that the $40,000 facility can give them a big book. They can go buy them their own book. You know, and some of those facilities, that's exactly what they want, is they want to use us for our literature. So I just caution you to be very careful about, you know, we don't want to be heartless. On the contrary, we want to serve as many places as we can. And any place that it's needed and they're confined. And but for our rule of thumb up in Sonoma County is we try to make sure, do they accept indigent people? That's the key. Because if they do, then their heart's in the right place. You know? So, I mean, those are some of the things that this committee's debated about for a long time. And I know in some areas they do those other facilities. And that's why, by the way, they changed the wording in the pink book so that you could. Because, you know, each area is autonomous. The general committee, we make suggestions and we go towards the book. But the reality is each area is autonomous and we have to respect that. And I also, you know, we serve areas. It goes all the way back to we serve the people that are putting that money into that pink can. So if you're bringing literature into a facility, make sure you understand that people, you know, we need to be prudent, we need to be careful, and we need to be conscious that what that money is meant for. You know, it's meant to carry into people who can't get out. There's a few things I wanted to... Oh, I know what I was going to tell you. I was going to tell you guys a couple of the exciting parts of how our general committee started. Our first general chairman died in office. Rex Ness was our general chairman from the time he started it in the late 40s until he died in the mid-50s. And then a guy named Bill Graves took over, and he got impeached in 1959 by Bud Clark. And Bud is the one who actually started forming a lot of the stuff that we see. But a lot of the things, you know, in this policy book, and this again goes to the history, you know, a lot of the things in here, just about everything in here is not our opinion. It's not what we thought was a good idea. It's what experience taught us, and often it's what facilities asked us. I always like to point out that, you know, there's a line in here about no swearing. And I want you to know that came from the guys in Folsom who actually threw out one of us who was coming in. They didn't throw him out, but they wrote to Bill Graves, who was the chairman at the time, and said, look, we know he's got a good heart, but we don't like his mouth. You know, they said, we live in a prison where we hear that kind of language all week long. We don't want to hear it that 1 hour a week that we have. So that's why we don't swear. A lot of it came from our state hospital. Agnew State Hospital wrote us some things. And then also, I was telling Mary, in 1956 at a conference in the NCC conference used to be where H&I general committees would be held. And we had it at the 1956 conference in San Jose is where we came up with the resolution that we shouldn't, where we started putting things like we need to tell them that we're not a hospital. We don't pay for treatment. We're not a, actually, I think the, we're not a religious organization. The Temperance Movement is a social service organization, has no paid social workers, a cure-all, an employment agency. Those all came out of a conference in 1956. So this came through experience. I mean, I guess that's the biggest thing I want to point out is that this was not just somebody's brilliant idea. I wrote some notes, by the way, just because I heard some stuff. I'm going to tell you a funny story about bridging the gap, just because I can't resist. Bridging the gap this morning, as you can see, it's a struggle to determine What's going on here? Well, we've been asking that for a long time. And back in the early 90s, they asked us to start carrying those cards. And so at our general committee, we actually talked about it and we decided, okay, we'll leave it up to the persons going in. If they choose to carry them in, it's okay with us. And if they choose not to, that's their business. But as far as the general committee was concerned, we were okay with it. So they brought us all these cards and asked us to pass them in. So we started doing it for about a year. And then up in Eureka, I believe it was 1994 or 95, up in Eureka, they come up and they said, you know, since you guys are the only ones who use the cards, would you pay to have them printed? And we like blew a gasket. You got to be kidding me. We're doing you a favor and now you want us to pay for them? So that was where a lot of the rift between Bridging the Gap and H&I came up, was in that one instance, because we were not going to pay for their work. And also, you know, they are not a part of H&I. We cooperate, not affiliate, which is also a very famous line that we have. Okay, a couple other things I wanted to put. Couple other things I'm just going to, and this is, goes really into the history, how this committee started. And this is something that, again, I have a little bit, but it's very, very important, I think. For those of you who are doing H&I, you know, we need to really bring in everybody that we're working with. You know, when I start working with somebody, I get them involved in the H&I committee. You know, I tend to do that. Most of the people in Santa Rosa do that, which, by the way, is why we have over 100 people at our area business meetings. I sometimes get a little disheartened when I look at the general committee, because we rotate all over, and when there's just not people bringing people in. You know, you can tell me you got 20 sponsees, but if you don't have a couple of them at the meeting, that tells me more than telling me you have 20 sponsees, you know. It's real important. The whole structure of H&I and our committee and how things get going is by us including people and bringing them along and helping them get involved. And if we don't keep doing that, we will die. We will die. And I just think it's very, very important. This whole committee started on that. That's how it got big. That's how it got going. I can remember when there was a whole contingent down here in Fresno, and there was a big one in Stockton, you know, and there was a big one in San Jose, and there was a big one in Sacramento, Cheeto, and those guys. And we, you know, and it just seems like over the years, it becomes not as important to get your sponsees involved or something. And then, you know, we start losing some of that which we have gained over the years. So I just, that's just... Okay, that's starting to sound like a lecture, so I'm getting off of that. Yeah, but I can lecture a lot, and I will say it's very difficult because my normal demeanor is not to be diplomatic. Matter of fact, I'm quite tactless. Just ask my wife. I do it all the time. By the way, I married that girl who said the people that mind don't matter and the ones that matter don't mind. That was Carmen. But... so my demeanor can be pretty tactless, but you know, but some of this stuff is real important to me when I look at how this committee's grown and what we do. And I can also tell you, for those of you who don't know a whole lot about H&I, you know, we get letters and we get letters. Peggy knows this now that she's getting the letters, but you know, we used to get letters from people all over the country. Who, you know, if somebody in South Dakota wants to start an H&I committee and they write New York, you know what New York does? It doesn't send them their treatment facility workbook. It says, if I were you, I would write Northern Cal H&I. They can help you. Because even they look at us as a model of how to better serve facilities. We serve more facilities than any place in the country. And a lot of why we do that is because we're organized in an endeavor just to do that. That's a big part of what we do. It's a little sad that I was thrilled to see the conference in Visalia. I was hoping, I was hoping upon anything that we could get some of you folks from around here interested in maybe doing Corcoran or helping Manuel in Avenaugh or Pleasant Valley, women, Chowchilla. You know, these we need people all the time, and we need to get, you know, unfortunately they open a prison for every, there's actually five prisons for every person in AA down in the Fresno area, it seems like, unfortunately. You know, they build them out where there's not a lot of people. So, and it's kind of unfortunate in the sense that a lot of the major facilities are right around here. And I will tell you, to show you how sick I am, when Ed and I were doing all that, we both actually talked about living somewhere down here just so we could do all the prisons real easy, because we were taking some really long drives to do the ones we were doing. So you guys should look at it as a gift. There's a lot of prisons that need your help right around here. And there's some great ones. And I've been in Corcoran. I see what they've got going there. I don't know how the meetings are going right now, but I was in there a long time ago, and they, boy, they all need your help. And I know Manuel needs help at Avenaugh, and I know Pleasant Valley's still going too, right? It's not going at all. Just no people, right? Yeah. See? By the way, Manuel and Richard go, they used to fly up to the meetings. They had a buddy who had an airplane, and they'd occasionally fly up when the meeting was in Eureka. They'd arrive, yeah, we're here for the H&I meeting. My fondest memories in Alcoholics Anonymous have to do with H&I, and I know I haven't covered a whole lot of the history. You know, and I can't, by the way, I don't want to sit here and talk about history for an hour either, because that really will put you to sleep. And I realize a lot of the stuff that might be fascinating to me may be of little interest to you, and actually of littler use. So I won't even go into all that. All I will tell you is that I love the fact that we have to learn from our experience, and we have to keep doing what we did that got us here. You know, it's that old saying, just like in sobriety, you know, if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. And if you're at that point in sobriety where that's starting to work for you, it just works the same way with hospitals and institutions. And, you know, it's no coincidence that whenever we get down to the actual work, the size of the group shrinks dramatically. You know, and we need to continually put an effort towards bringing that group up. That's what we need to focus our energies on. And I believe that as members of the General Committee, that's something we really need to focus on, is to bring more people into the fold of H&I, to encourage people to come, to encourage people to just do facilities, even if they don't want to come to the steering committees. And we still need those services covered, because our obligation is to serve facilities first. Everything else comes secondary. So anyway, with that, I've talked long enough. You guys, I'm out of wind, and you might need a break anyway. So thanks for listening.